Gareth, you were recently asked the question about queer ancestors and who has inspired you.
And it's such an interesting question, because actually when I started looking back, I started seeing these wonderful people kind of come into my mind. Maybe if I just give you a little bit of context first of all. So I founded the website pridenz.com in 2009, and it contains over 1,000 audio recordings of events and interviews relating to rainbow communities. So in fact, it's the largest online audio repository of rainbow voices from Aotearoa. One of the whole things about Pride NZ is making rainbow stories and experiences easily accessible and also visible, and the internet obviously gives us an amazing opportunity to do that. And when I was looking back, thinking about the five people that have really inspired me, and I think probably inspired how Pride NZ has developed through their activities. So these are activists and documentarians. They're actually all still alive. So I would say they are my five living queer ancestors, because they're all thankfully still with us. They have all, in their own ways, at the time of an event that's happened, they have documented that event or been part of that event. They have then either catalogued the event or described it or preserved it, and ultimately all have made it accessible in some way. They've shared that information for the betterment of all our communities. And these are precisely the things that, you know, Pride NZ is kind of underpinned by. They wanted that material out there. They wanted it to be reused in, you know, obviously appropriate ways. But they, all of them, have carried forward the voices and experiences of people that are no longer here. And if it wasn't for these five people, we would be so much the poorer.
So, who's on your list?
Here we go. These are five people that have been incredibly influential. And I would say, while they're not blood ancestors, we are still connected by this real desire to kind of capture and preserve and make visible all of these amazing stories and people from our past. So the first person I would like to mention is Linda Evans. Now, Linda is a activist based up on the Kapiti Coast from the kind of Wellington region. She's an activist, historian, and has been involved in feminist, lesbian, and gay rights organising from the 1970s onwards. She's also a curator for the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand. So that is now Kawe Mahara. It changed its name a year or two ago. When I was researching about my queer ancestors, I wrote to Linda just to get a few more details, because I was really interested in her work when she worked at what we now know as Radio New Zealand in the 1970s doing the press clippings. And she gave me a few notes. She was saying that she worked in the library between 1977 and 1990 and managed it from about 1983 onwards. And it was called the Broadcasting Reference Library, which was part of the BCNZ, and it kind of provided print research services to journalists and program makers for Radio New Zealand, TVNZ, and The Listener. One of the key things that Linda was doing in that role were the daily press clippings. So this actually literally involved going through all of the daily newspapers of the time and clipping out news stories and then filing them by theme. This was incredibly important, because this was at a time when, you know, it was typewriters and paper documentation rather than computer databases and internet searches. So physical newspaper clippings were incredibly important, and to actually have them historically curated together and filed in these were big, weren't they? They were brown paper envelopes,
huge folders.
And so it was done thematically, it was done for notable individuals, just a wealth of information. So when I first started at Radio New Zealand in the early 1990s, I came across these press clippings in what was then called, I think, InfoFind, which was the Radio New Zealand Library. And it was the first time I'd really come across coverage of homosexuality and the struggle for homosexual law reform. You would think, oh, well, okay, that's the 80s. it actually dated right back to the 1960s. And so right from the 1960s onwards, you had media mentions of homosexuality and homosexual law reform. And sadly, a lot of the mentions of homosexuality were to do with criminal cases. This was more about with homosexuals being the victim of a crime, whether it was a killing, a beating up, a blackmail attempt, and so on. But at least those mentions were there, and it gave you breadcrumbs to discover more. This was at a time when I wasn't out, so actually I didn't know of any kind of rainbow voices in the media, but they were there. I just wasn't kind of open to that, I guess. And I mean, I'm guessing you've had a similar experience where you can actually have quite parallel lives running where you're not out, and so you don't see things that are actually right in front of you.
Mm, yeah, there can be a whole lot of things happening that maybe subconsciously you know somehow has relationship to you or is relevant to you, but not it's not sort of staring you in the face as though this is the big issue of the day for me. Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, kind of the mid-1990s that I realized there is such a rich history of rainbow voices in all types of media here in Aotearoa, but particularly in kind of activist newspapers, things like Pink Triangle, that just stunning amounts of information that we can really learn from. So yeah, if it hadn't been for Linda's work in the 1970s and through the 80s, all of that stuff would have been very hard to find. I mean, even now, you imagine having to Google search or search through newspapers that may not have been digitized, and pull out every kind of mention of homosexuality. So Linda did an amazing job there. And Linda's team, of course, it wasn't just Linda. We did an interview with Linda on Pride NZ about her involvement in law reform activities, and this one's by Jack Lynch, and we've got a short clip of Linda talking about a protest action against the Salvation Army during homosexual law reform.
One of the ones that I particularly enjoyed was we went to the Salvation Army and asked for our money back because it was being used against us. I mean, it was just, you would never get it back, and we didn't. But we all, in Wellington, we went along at lunchtime and queued up outside their office in Cuba Street and asked for our money back.
The money from where? From
the collections. That, you know, because the thing is, that was what was so damaging about them taking the petition around, that people were used to them coming around. They were used to them collecting. Many people did saw the Salvation Army as basically socially benevolent, doing good things. And so we said, well, we gave our money to their collections and now we wanted it back because it was being used to fund this campaign against us. So just things like that, we just sort of turned it around, because some of it is the activist stuff of you know, having actions that will be people will enjoy to do. And then there's also that kind of tradition of humour and of camp stuff in our communities. So we wanted to build on all of that. You know, when we had a dress-up picket, which, I don't know, it was crazy, but outside the Citadel in Webb Street, the people dressed up as victims and oppressors. So, I mean, it was just like trying to keep things moving, keep ourselves going, make a point, and be out there. And I think, you know, and we were not going to be silenced. We were not going to have other people speak. We wanted other people to speak for us and with us, but we were not going to pull back and say they should take the lead.
One of the other people documenting queer life in the 1970s, and another one of your queer ancestors, was the photographer Kim Strathdee.
Now, Kim is amazing. Kim was born in Auckland in the 1950s, now lives in Sydney, but he runs a Facebook page called So Far From Kansas, and so every day he posts a daily image from his really comprehensive photographic archive. His photography kind of begins in the early 1970s and covers queer communities in Auckland, Wellington, Sydney, Melbourne, and San Francisco. He's really captured a large number of large events, including things like the Hero Parades in Auckland, also Pride Marches, but he's also really interested in documenting everyday queer lives. Among his, I would say, tens of thousands of images, so these are both physical negatives and also digital images, he's got a whole collection of images relating to the late Georgina Beyer. Georgina Beyer being the world's first openly transgender mayor and world's first openly transgender member of parliament. And Kim photographed Georgina right the way from the early 1970s right the way into the 2000s. Really fortunate I was to be able to interview Kim a couple of years ago when he was here in Wellington, and he really talked about how he was entirely self-taught and how he prioritized his kind of instinct over technical perfection to kind of grab the shot. He saw the camera as both a shield and a bridge, so when he was at events, it kind of allowed him to participate in an event, but also he was an observer, which I thought was really, really fascinating. So here's a very short clip of Kim talking.
My camera didn't give me a license to behave in a certain way, but it filled in for something that I can't quite often bridge myself, and I'll find myself going and doing it because we only come together like this once. And I don't process that thought, but I have that in my thoughts all the time, is we, now that I'm older and we've lost so many people, and that we should not be wallowing in our loss about those people that we've lost, but we should value this today that we've got with each other, and we shouldn't lay shit on other people because life's really, really precious. And you know, I mean, if you look through the archive that I've got spanning about all those years, and I get people that come onto my site, on my site on Facebook, who go, "Oh, I just love all your photographs. It's just a shame. There's so many. We've lost so many." And yeah, we have. We must not let our loss become more important than what those people brought to our lives or what they brought to our community. And some of them were assholes.
That's Kim Strathdy, the amazing photographer. What I saw in Kim as a photographer was somebody who was really weaving community memory and sustaining that community memory, and not only taking the photographs, but then also displaying them on a kind of a daily basis. What I found with Kim was an incredibly generous person for making his images available to the community. So when Georgina Beyer passed a few years ago, we held a large memorial event, a celebration of Georgina at the Embassy Theatre in Wellington, and by far the majority of images that were projected on the big screen were Kim's, and it was only because Kim had been with Georgina for so many years photographing her and then making those available. It was incredible. He's incredibly generous, and I think that is again something that feeds into Pride NZ, the sense that actually we are collecting these stories, these taonga, but we are really caretakers of them, and we're caretaking them for the future, and they're meant to be heard, they're meant to be used, obviously in the right ways, but it's not about locking them down. Kim's collection stretches across an incredibly significant time period for rainbow communities, so documenting gay liberation in the 1970s, the first appearances of HIV AIDS in the early 1980s, the way that living with HIV has changed from then to now, also the homosexual law reform, marriage equality, a whole range of things. So it's an incredible archive that Kim has and he is very generous with.
Peter Noland is a broadcaster.
An amazing broadcaster. If we go back to the mid-80s, Peter was out there during homosexual law reform activity, so like pro and anti rallies and marches and demonstrations, and he was there with his audio recorder, which I think was a cassette recorder at the time. Technology has changed so rapidly. But he was recording the actuality from those events. So these were things like chants and speeches and atmosphere and interviews. Quite remarkable. Just to give a bit of context, so Wellington Central MP Fran Wild introduced the Homosexual Law Reform Bill in March 1985. Now, it set out to decriminalise homosexuality between consenting males over the age of 16 and also make it an offence to discriminate against someone based on their sexual orientation. Hoi, the legislation. I'm sighing even just thinking about it, because the legislation took 16 months before it got partially passed by four votes in July 1986. So if you can imagine, almost nightly on the news, there were stories about homosexuality and homosexual law reform. So it was incredibly draining for everyone involved. Peter was making his audio recordings for broadcast on Wellington Access Radio. Now, Wellington Access Radio is the first permanent community radio station in New Zealand. So it was established in 1981. And community radio, like the name suggests, is all about empowering anyone to make radio for their communities. So there was no external editor saying you couldn't, could or couldn't do something or say something. So in the mid-1980s in Wellington, we had the Lesbian Community Radio Program, and harking back to Linda Evans, Linda was one of the key members of the Lesbian Community Radio Program, and we also had Gay BC, which is the Gay Broadcasting Collective. And these two shows were incredibly vital for connecting our rainbow communities together, because this is at a time when there was no social media. There was, you know, the internet for most people didn't exist. There were no cell phones very much. So this is a way of connecting rainbow communities together. Also at the time, you could discriminate against gay people. People could lose their employment. People could lose their accommodation simply for being perceived to be gay. There was no anti-discrimination measures in place. And so a lot of people were actually in the closet. So actually listening to the radio and getting that sense of community kind of privately was maybe the only way they were connecting. So off Peter would go to these events with his cassette recorder and capture all this actuality. And years later, in 2006, I was actually working with Linda on a preservation project for what was the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, and we were preserving Peter's tapes, and my goodness, they are pure gold. So while state media, so things like Radio New Zealand and Television New Zealand, were capturing politicians debating law reform, Peter was really capturing the essence of what it was like to be standing up and demanding change. He was right there because he is actually part of the community as well. So he had this kind of amazing access. He also saw the importance of capturing viewpoints from both sides. So this wasn't about kind of platforming anti-queer rhetoric, but it was knowing that actually in 30 years' time, you need to have the antis argument on tape to make documentaries. Actually, that's incredibly important. And so when you hear that really nasty MP Norman Jones talking about, you know, gays going back into the sewers, it's much stronger when he is screaming it out than somebody reenacting it. So, you know, Peter really saw this, and thank goodness he was able to capture this stuff. So in 2006, again, this is the, was it the 20th anniversary of homosexual law reform? 2006, yes. I made a documentary called 20 Years Out, and this is the first time that a lot of Peter's work had been broadcast nationally on Radio New Zealand. Prior to this point, it had been heard on things like community radio, but this is the first time when people nationally heard this material, and It had a huge impact. I mean, people literally, you know, stopped in their cars to listen because Peter's material is so raw. And you kind of listen to it now and you think, I can't believe a Member of Parliament would say that kind of stuff.
Well, Linda mentioned a bit earlier about an activist action, I suppose we'd call it an activation these days, during law reform, where people went to the Salvation Army to demand their donated money back. And Peter Noland was there and he recorded it. So let's take a listen to some of that.
We gave our money because we considered that the Salvation Army helped all people. And you took our money under false pretences. Your money doesn't help all people. It helps the ones you decide you're going to help, and that doesn't include queers.
It's a major departure. I mean, we had only to realise, think that you were going to follow your normal policies and the kind of services you've always provided. We weren't to know you were going to make this major departure from your previous policy and use the money in this way. And I think a lot of people would give money to the Salvation Army not asking for receipts because they just trust it's a small amount, as Bill said, and it doesn't really matter, you know, you're not worried about that for tax purposes unless you're giving hundreds and thousands. But also you trust that the Salvation Army will do what they've always done with it.
Let's come back to the core issue that was the question right at the start of the proceedings. You have requested for your donations back. Okay. I'm saying to you again, you'll have to put it in writing.
Well,
and you'll
we'll
have
put
to
it
request
in writing
it.
Now.
I'm sorry, I can't do that. Individuals have to write
it.
I'm
going to do it individually now.
No, I'm sorry. I've got an engagement anyway, which I'm already late for at 1:30, and I'm going to have to slip away. We've had, three quarters of an hour of discussion?
I'm sure there's someone else that can help us.
Well, there's no one here. The place is
empty. I just saw a woman go through the back door.
Oh, well, I don't know anything about that. I wouldn't
mind.
Doesn't
she work here?
Somebody probably
someone
came.
Someone broke in then.
Oh, come on now. Why would people want to do that?
No, well, I'm saying if you don't know who she is, I mean, she just came through.
Well, there may have been one of the secretaries put her head in the door
and went
out again.
Well, why can't she expedite this?
I'm not prepared.
It's ridiculous for you to say that you're closing the office now.
No, I
mean,
I'm
we
not
want
gonna,
some action on this.
And I'm asking you that if you like to write an
No, I think you should be more helpful than that. I think you should give us
I will give you a stamped address envelope to send back.
Will you? Oh, will you get? You'll give us the stamped address envelopes now.
No, that's not what I'm saying. You write in and request.
Why can't we have the stamped address envelopes now?
I think
now,
we're
then?
Going around in a bit of a circle.
No, why should we? You mean you want us to use a stamp writing to you?
I'm sorry. There's no more to be said. We've covered the ground.
All right.
It's over to you to reply in writing, and we will action.
So the.
Well, also documenting these events was the photographer David Hindley.
David, another stunning photographer, was working for the activist magazine Pink Triangle, which was based in Wellington. And so he was going out and photographing street marches and demonstrations, particularly outside places like the Salvation Army and other rallies. There's a great sequence of images. One of a meeting that was held in the Wellington Town Hall where it got very rowdy. A lot of finger pointing. And there's another series of images at, was it the Knox Church Hall in Lower Hutt, where the anti-reformers had were holding a meeting, and some pro-reform activists came to the meeting and said, actually, we want equal time to tell you about, you know, what actually the law will actually mean. And the antis didn't want it. And so I think Bill Logan got up and, you know, got people to throw change at the stage. So they kind of bought half the time. And there's some really fantastic kind of fast moving images from both the town hall and the Knox Church rallies. And David had this amazing eye of being able to compose in camera these fast paced kind of action events that you just don't know, you know, what was going to happen next. He actually also developed his own black and white film in his laundry flat, apparently. So, you know, full of lots of talents. The big thing with David's images is that he has been so generous about allowing other people to publish them and republish them and show them in exhibitions. You know, very he's very open to having this material out there, and it's an incredibly generous spirit.
And these are some of the, I guess now iconic images from the period, which people repeatedly go back to. A few years ago, you interviewed David.
I did. I was really interested in just understanding how he got that access. There were shots that he took when he was on stage looking back at the crowd. How did he get that kind of access, and what were those kind of events actually like? So here's a bit of a short clip of him talking.
People were generally accepting of the fact that they were being photographed. I think they knew that they were involved in something which was very, very newsworthy, which was quite a big historical event. And so generally people accepted that. Some people were very, very happy to be photographed. Other people were quite uncomfortable. And occasionally you had to really size up how you were going to take a photograph and then grab it when the opportunity came, because you knew that the person wouldn't otherwise allow you to do it.
And I guess at this time, when homosexuality was illegal, to actually have a published photo of yourself in a gay magazine, that must have been quite challenging for some people.
Well, it absolutely was, because, of course, this was before the days of anti-discrimination legislation and things like that. So people could potentially be thrown out of their jobs, thrown out of their flats and things like that. And that did happen from time to time. This was also the days of police entrapments, of police going around and hassling people in gay bars and that type of thing. So there were definitely the potential for repercussions for people who were photographed.
I've got to say, these shots that you've taken are beautifully composed, and I'm wondering how do you compose shots in such a fluid situation as protests or rallies?
I think the key is really just being prepared to take the photograph when the absolute moment is right, and so you just have to be primed and ready to just kind of click whenever you need to. I think that one of the other things is being in the middle of things and just getting a sense of how activities are developed, seeing how things might develop, looking at two protagonists walking towards each other and thinking, right, there's going to be something happen here, so I'll get ready to take the photograph. I'd also like to urge anyone who's taking photographs now to store them very carefully and to print them out. One of the advantages I had of taking photographs with film is that I have the negatives, and Leigh-Anne's will have the negatives, and so there's a record, there's a permanent record there. One of the great dangers with digital photography is people take a great photograph but don't print it out, don't store it properly. It gets deleted. And there are some events which have actually been very well covered with photographs, but there aren't any photographs left because they were all taken digitally and they've since been erased. So if you're taking images of something which may have value in the future, then for goodness sake, save it.
And that was David Hindley talking. I think the last queer ancestor you want to talk about is and acknowledge is the filmmaker Peter Duncan.
Peter Duncan, gosh. Okay, so we're moving just a bit later in time, so we're in the late 80s, early 90s now, and Peter is a filmmaker, and he was filming people in rainbow communities here in Wellington. He now lives in Australia. So he was filming things like the annual Lesbian and Gay Fair, so that began in 1986. It still continues today as Out in the City. He filmed the Devotion Festivals, so these are back in the early 1990s, the Love Parade, and a really poignant unveiling of the New Zealand AIDS Memorial at the Michael Fowler Centre. To give you a little bit of context about HIV and AIDS in New Zealand, AIDS diagnoses peaked in 1989 in New Zealand with 71 cases, and deaths peaked in 1992 with 66 people dying from AIDS-related conditions. And so Peter was documenting at a time when it was a really significant kind of health crisis for rainbow communities. I mean, not just rainbow communities, because we know it's not confined to rainbow communities, but Peter was focusing on the rainbow communities. One of the really significant moments that Peter filmed was the Beacons of Hope Memorial held at Frank Kitts Park on the waterfront in 1993. And this was the 10th anniversary of AIDS memorials. They started back in the US, and this is the 10th anniversary of those. And so the Beacons of Hope in Wellington was actually leading the world in terms of AIDS memorials for that year. So Thousands of people attended. They carried torches and candles. Torches were carried for each person that had been lost to AIDS-related conditions. And the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra and Youth Choir performed. And Rog, you were actually at Beacons of Hope.
Yes, yeah, I was there. I remember it pretty clearly as a very moving and somber occasion, but also incredibly epic and powerful, mainly because of the torches and the calling of the names of people who had passed on towards the end. But I also remember, maybe strangely, I don't know, it's a strange feeling, but I remember feeling really proud to be there. And that's because at the time I was working for the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra. It was my first job after graduating from uni. And the orchestra were playing at this event, and they were playing a piece of music by a New Zealand composer, Kenneth Young. And in fact, he was conducting the orchestra, and they had the National Youth Choir singing. And I just remember being so proud that this organization, the orchestra that I worked for, was really backing this, was really 100% in support of the event, of the occasion, and showing their support for the whole memorial occasion. And this was a national arts organization, and I just remember feeling very, very moved and proud that this national organization that I worked for was right there, right behind, really supporting this really powerful event.
There were also speakers at the event, so people like Eve Van Grafthorst, the girl from Australia who had come over from Australia with her mother, also Catherine O'Regan, who was the Associate Health Minister, and this is just prior to the Human Rights Act going through Parliament, and so Catherine was campaigning to have it within the Act that you could not discriminate against people with HIV and among other things. So that was really amazing. To my knowledge, apart from television snippets I've seen of Beacons of Hope, I think Peter has maybe the only complete and comprehensive footage of that event, and it was such a significant event. And so Peter filmed it. I think he filmed it on 8mm and also video, and he's made that footage available, and that is just incredible. So we've actually got a little bit of audio from the Beacons of Hope film that Peter Duncan filmed.
Our next speaker is responsible for introducing into Parliament the current Human Rights Amendment Bill, and has often put herself and career on the line in the fight against discrimination. Please welcome the Associate Minister for Health, Catherine O'Regan. Beacons of hope. Beacons of hope and candles which will lighten the lives of many ahead of us. Today, we commemorate those who have died of AIDS. We join with families, with lovers, with friends throughout New Zealand who have had to cope with grief, with prejudice, and always with anguish. Tonight, we affirm the rights of people with AIDS to be treated in a compassionate way, to be free from the stigma the disease brings with it, and to live their lives in dignity. Let us ensure that for the future, we speak freely of HIV/AIDS without fear and without prejudice. For my part, I shall do all in my power to amend the human rights legislation, and all I ask of New Zealanders is for them to open their hearts and their minds to the suffering of those people and to let prejudice be gone.
So So that's just a little bit of audio from the Beacons of Hope event, which happened in 1993 at Frank Kitts Park on the waterfront. And, you know, Peter Duncan, filmmaker, not only filmed it, he edited it, he's preserved it by making it into a digital format, and he's sharing it. And all of these elements, I guess, humbled at that he is so generous with his material. All of the five people I've talked about, I think, over the last few minutes, have got aspects that have really shaped me and shaped the development of Pride NZ. And I am eternally grateful that these people stepped up and saw that there were significant moments in rainbow history happening, documented them, preserved them, but then made them accessible as well. I think it's just such a gift.
So in so many ways, this is a tribute to those who have documented and archived history, our history, rainbow history. I've got one final question for you, and that is, in the future, people will look back on your life and works. So how would you like to be remembered?
It's an interesting question because, like, we both work in the kind of cultural heritage sector, and we see on a daily basis sometimes collectors from the past are boxed into various boxes, and, you know, it's either good or bad, depending on, you know, which way the wind's blowing, and are seen in a very kind of superficial light. I think the thing with everyone is that we're all really complex. You know, we have good and we have bad. And I think if I was to be remembered at all, I would like to be kind of shown in that complexity rather than just good or bad. I mean, I'm hoping it's not bad. But you know, like, I think we do our best with what we've got to make the world a better place. And, you know, it's really hard to think in 50 years' time how people are going to judge you for what you did or didn't do. All I can say is I tried my best with the privilege that I have, because we all have privilege, and my God, we're living in Aotearoa, New Zealand. With the privilege that I had, I tried to make the world a better place, and I hope that's how I'll be judged.